From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a visit with Paul Simon. The singer-songwriter just was awarded the first Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for popular song. And there's a new collection of his music called The Essential Paul Simon. He became famous in the mid-60s as half of the folk rock duo Simon & Garfunkel, then moved on to a successful solo career. And we meet John Peterson, a.k.a. Farmer John. He took a failing family farm and built a successful community-supported agriculture project. A documentary about his life is now in theaters. And film critic David Edelstein reviews three new summer movies, Ratatouille, Sicko, and Live Free or Die Hard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week, a PBS concert special paid tribute to Paul Simon, the first recipient of a new award from the Library of Congress. It's the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, and celebrates both the range and durability of Simon's music, a catalog that spans half a century. Simon's music career began in the 1950s, when he was still in high school. He recorded a hit record with his childhood pal Art Garfunkel under the name Tom and Jerry. A few years later, they started recording under their own names as Simon and Garfunkel. They became one of the most popular folk-influenced groups of the 60s, recording such hits as Sounds of Silence, Homeward Bound, Mrs. Robinson, and Bridge Over Troubled Water. Simon's gift for catchy melodies and intriguing, unusual lyrics hasn't abandoned him over the years. From Paul Simon's latest album, Surprise, here's his song, Father and Daughter.
If you leap awake in the mirror of a bad dream, and for a fraction of a second you can't remember where you are, just open your window and follow your memory upstream to the meadow in the mountain where we counted every falling star. I believe the light that shines on you will shine on you forever, and though I can't guarantee there's nothing scary hiding under your bed, I'm gonna stand guard like a postcard of a golden retriever, and never leave till I leave you with a sweet dream in your head. I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know, as long as one and one is two, there could never be a father loved his daughter more than I love you.
Terry spoke to Paul Simon in 2000. She asked him about his early days in the music business when he worked for a music publishing company.
It was just when I was coming out of college, and they offered to pay me, I think, $150 a week, which seemed like so much money that I really couldn't refuse it. But I was probably never more miserable than doing that. And my job was to go and take the songs that this huge publishing company owned and go around to record companies and to A&R men at record companies and see if any of their artists wanted to record The Peanut Vendor, or which I think was one of their songs or something like that. And I worked for them for, about 6 months maybe. And I never got one song placed. But I did give them a couple of my songs that I was writing because I felt so guilty about taking their...
Which songs?
Their check. Very early songs, I think, like Bleecker Street. Maybe some songs that weren't even recorded. And then I got into an argument with them. And I said, look, you know, I quit. I'm out of here. I don't want to work here anymore. And I'm not giving you my new song. And see ya. And the song that I had just written was The Sound of Silence. And I said, I'll just publish this myself. And from that point on, I've owned all of my songs. So that was a lucky argument that I had with this guy.
Well, why don't we hear it? And this is Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound
of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw.
Continuing and talking about your early career in music. I think it was during that era when you were working for the publishing company that you also ended up cutting demos. And this was before there were Simon and Garfunkel hits. Were you doing demos for other singers of how songs should sound?
Yeah, I was doing demos for a long time. The publishing company job, that was only a few months.
Mm-hmm.
That was really an anomaly. But the demos was really how I learned to record. That's how I learned about recording technique. Because I was in the studio several days a week. And for a while, I did a lot of demos with Carole King. And we worked as a team because she could play drums and piano, and I could play guitar and bass. And we could sing the parts and make up background parts and do it pretty quickly. And what it was writers would have a song that they wanted some specific artist to sing, and they'd, you know, give you the song, and you'd try and make it a demo that would appeal to that artist.
So did you learn a lot about craft when you were doing all these demos? Well, not only what it took to make a good song, but then what it took to put a song across on record?
I learned how to record. You know, how you got sounds on a record, and learn to be comfortable in a studio playing, and to, you know, get it relatively quickly in a couple of takes because there wasn't much time. They'd book studios by the hour, and you tried to do two or three songs in an hour because you got paid by the song. So I began to learn, you know, what studios and around town had facilities that maybe I could use, and who was good, and what tricks or whatever information that you would amass by, you know, doing the task over and over again, week after week. And I did that for a few years, like 2 or 3 years, maybe more. And All of that experience was, you know, very useful to me by the time I got up to recording the first album for Columbia, the Simon and Garfunkel first album.
There's a demo that was released on a box set of Bridge Over Troubled Water, you doing the demo of it.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to play this because I think it's really interesting to hear you, you know, doing the demo version of it. And before we hear it, I'm wondering, is this on a higher key than the actual record is?
Well, I'm not sure what key it is or what key the record is. It's the key that I wrote it on the guitar, and it was too high, so I'm going into falsetto also. I'm not really doing anything other than sketching out a demo, so.
Right.
But I decided somewhere relatively early, I can't remember exactly when, relatively early that the song should be played with piano, like a gospel song. And I was listening to a lot of gospel music at that time, the Swan Silvertones and the Soul Stirrers and Dixie Hummingbirds. Those were the groups I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some idea about a gospel sound that I wanted, and there was a piano. So I knew that the song was going to change to piano, and my instinct was that Artie should sing it. So that's the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear your demo version of it. This is Paul Simon.
When you're weary, feeling sad, when peace is all you seek, I will be there. Ooh.
to bring you sleep. When times are hard and pain is all around, like a bridge over troubled waters, I would lay me down, like a bridge over troubled waters, I would lay me down.
Paul Simon speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Paul Simon. She asked if he could remember the first music which really made an impression on him.
My first memory of being taken with a piece of music was, it was a summer day and I was waiting for a Yankee game to come on. And I was listening to the show that preceded the Yankee game. And I was going to score the game, so I was filling out the score, my scorecard, getting ready for the game to begin. And the show was a pop music show, and it was called, I think it was called Make Believe Ballroom. And the disc jockey said, here's a record that they've given to me. He said, this has to be one of the worst records I've ever heard. He said, if this record is a hit, I'll eat my hat. And he played a record called G by the Crows. And I thought, as I was filling out my lineup, that's the first thing I've heard on that show that I thought was decent. I couldn't stand all the rest of it. And it was an R&B record. So that's my first recollection. Then the next thing, of course, was that Alan Freed's show, which was called The Moondog Show, was played on WINS in New York. And what he played was sort of a mix of doo-wop and rhythm and blues, but it also had, in those early days, the Sun Record people, Presley, Perkins, Johnny Cash, and a year or so later, the Everly Brothers. So there was a pretty wide variety of what was then called rock and roll. And I just thought it all belonged together. And soon after that I began to write. I wrote my first song. It was called The Girl For Me. And it was a doo-wop song, and it was sung around. And lots of little groups sang it in the neighborhood. It wasn't just our group. It sort of became famous in a couple of adjacent neighborhoods. In a way, it was like a hit. And then pretty soon after that, I'm talking about age 14 now, but by age 15, I wrote a song with Artie called Hey School Girl. And we went into some studio and made a demo of it. For $5, you could make a recording if you recorded it directly onto acetate and didn't use the tape. $5. And we made that, and there was some guy waiting to use the studio after us who heard it, and he said, I have a record company. I'd like to put that record out. He asked, you know, to call our parents. And he did, and we made our first record, and it was a hit. I mean, it sold like 100,000 copies or something and was in the top 5 or 10 in New York. And I think it got into the top 50 nationally. And that was the first record that we made.
Why did you use the names Tom and Jerry for this record?
We didn't. The record company gave it to us. if you think back to 1957, which you probably, I don't know if you can or you can't, because I don't know how old you are.
I can.
Okay. It was really impossible to use an ethnic name. You couldn't use those names that had any ethnicity. In fact, it was a daring move in 1964 when Columbia Records said, I don't think you guys should be called, I think you should go by your name. I think you should be called Simon and Garfunkel. When that first happened in 1964, there was a lot of, like, is that a law firm kind of jokes? And
a Catskills Act.
Exactly. And so that really what was going on in 1957. That was unheard of, that anybody would be entering into pop music from that didn't have Anglo-Saxon name. So the guy who owned the record company gave us the name Tom and Jerry after the cartoon characters.
You've done a lot of investigation of international musics, particularly music of Africa, Latin America. When did you start getting the impulse to listen to music that was that far away from home? I mean, this was before Afropop became, you know, very popular. How were you first exposed to it, and why did you decide to get deeper into it?
I think I was first exposed to it with Alan Freed and what I said earlier. When you mix into the same half hour something by Carl Perkins and The Moon Glows and Ruth Brown and Ray Charles and Johnny Cash, and you call it all rock and roll, and you say it's all the same because it's called rock and roll. What you're really talking about, or Fats Domino, what you're really talking about is music from Louisiana, which is heavily syncopated and influenced by Caribbean rhythms, which are really West African, and or the Everly's, or Carl Perkins, and that music is, in the Everly's case, that's like that's Appalachian influenced, and so that's coming from a Celtic tradition, and Frankie Lyman and the doo-wop groups, they're coming from a gospel quartet, which is also a mix of African and English. And so very early on, I was exposed to a lot of different cultures. Just nobody explained it that way. Plus, my father was a musician, and he played music from his era, which was probably the big band era. And he often used to play at Roseland Ballroom in New York, and there was another band on that would play with him. And it was a Latin band, so I heard Latin music, too.
Tell me more about your father, about what he played, what kind of music.
Well, he played bass, and he played all kinds of music. And it was a generation of musicians that prided themselves on the fact that they could play all kinds of music.
Well, did his band play for, like, bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like that?
Could do that. The band could play that, or it could play at a dance place like Roseland, mm-hmm. or he was on the Arthur Godfrey television show. He was in that band. He made some records. He was on some of the early rock and roll records. Somebody
really
call him up and book him, and he'd play. Really, it was a generation, as I said, that prided themselves on just put the music in front of me, and I can play it. It's whatever it is, there's a familiarity with it, if not a great expertise. So anyway, my background was, I was exposed to a lot of different music. I wasn't interested in most of it, and only liked this, certain kinds of rock and roll. But I remembered all of it.
Did you and your father have any music wars, music conflicts? Like a lot of people growing up in the 50s had these big fights in the car, for instance, about who would control the radio. Would you listen to the station that played Papa Loves Mambo and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, or would you listen to the station that was playing Elvis Presley?
No, we didn't really have any fights about that. He was an easygoing guy. He wasn't going to... He didn't think much of that music.
Of which music?
That I liked. Of the music that I liked. He thought it was... He really thought it was really too simple. And from his point of view, he was a well-trained musician. It was very simple. Harmonically, what wasn't simple was how to actually do it and make it be good. It's easy to mistake something that's simple for having, you know, little value. Actually, it's pretty hard to be simple and good, as I've found out, you know, many times.
Paul Simon speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. He just received the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song from the Library of Congress. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
It's outrageous to line your pockets off the misery of the poor. Outrageous the crime some human beings must endure. It's a blessing to wash your face in the summer solstice rain. It's outrageous a man like me stand here and complain, but I'm tired. 900 sit-ups a day. I'm painting my hair the color of mud, okay? I'm tired. Anybody care what I say? No. Painting my hair the color of mud. Who's gonna love you when your looks are gone? Tell me who's gonna...
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Joyce Foundation, dedicated to protecting the Great Lakes, fresh water at the heart of America, joycefdn.org. And from the Dial Press, publisher of The Manny, a novel about life on the wealthiest acre of Manhattan's Upper East Side by Holly Peterson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the real dirt on Farmer John. We meet John Peterson, who took his family's land and created a successful agriculture project. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Ratatouille, Sicko, and Live Free or Die Hard. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, family farms across the U.S. were disappearing. Some of that land was swallowed up by larger corporate farming operations. Urban sprawl took over other plots of land that used to grow food. Our next guest, John Peterson, lost his farm in the early 80s. It had been in his family for generations. A documentary about Peterson called The Real Dirt on Farmer John is being released theatrically. It's directed by Taggart Siegel. It shows how Peterson later was able to start a successful organic farm, now one of the largest community-supported agriculture operations in the U.S. John Peterson took over his family's farm when he was still in high school, after his father died in the late 1960s. His family had 350 acres, on which it grew corn and soybeans and raised chickens, cows, and hogs. When Peterson went to college, he continued to run the farm. In addition to the conventional farming, it became a home, or a home away from home, for a lot of his friends, hippies and artists, who camped on the property and farmed along with Peterson. Many eventually rented houses in the area, raising crops together. Terry spoke with John Peterson in 2006.
The film says that after a while, after you took over your family farm, you were hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to banks, friends, and loan sharks. What got you so deep into debt?
Optimism.
What do you mean?
Well, my mom would say, back in the 50s and in the early 60s when agriculture was still flourishing a bit, and occasionally you'd see a barn being built in the community, and my mom would say, there's a family that believes in the future. They're building a new barn. And capital is what fuels expansion, and I felt that I could undertake indebtedness and that I would somehow be able to, you know, prosper my way out of it, because I had this deep sense of the farm as my destiny, and the thought of losing it was, it was actually inaccessible to me. There was really no possibility in my mind, in my being, that this farm could ever be lost. So I was really quite casual in taking on debt to renovate the buildings, to finance the acquisitions of equipment. And, I mean, there were a lot of charts at the time that would justify that kind of expansion. I don't think they would have justified putting money into celebrations and some of the renovation work that we did on the farm. But as far as that kind of expansion, that was very commonplace back then. And there was this idea that a certain scale was essential to survive as a farmer. So I borrowed a lot of money. And then this impossible thing happened. The banks were calling the loans. So this idea that I had, or this, I guess I'd almost have to call it a knowledge, it was challenged. It was, you know, it was exploded.
How did the loan sharks come into it? Because you mentioned you owed money to loan sharks, too.
Oh, my. There was a, at that time when some of the farms were starting to get really shaky in the early 80s, there was, one organization in particular that advertised that it had sources of capital. And desperate people, which I was becoming, will do desperate things. I went to an attorney during that time. I wanted to come up with, I think, $300,000 or $350,000. And he asked me a few questions, and he finally said, well, I can get you the money, but the problem is you don't have children. And I said, well, why is that a problem? He said, well, the people who will lend you the money, they know that they're not going to get far threatening you, but they're going to come to you if you don't repay them, and they're going to threaten to kneecap your children, and they're going to tell you exactly when they get out of school, and they're going to tell you exactly like what they wore to school on certain days, so you will know that your children are under surveillance. And then when the loan is due, you're going to find a way to come up with it, because you're not going to let that happen to your kids. Well, I was so shaken by what I was descending into. So when I drove away from his office that day, I realized that it was time to put the land up for sale.
You were very depressed after you sold the farm. You traveled for a few years. Eventually, you decided you wanted to become a farmer again, and you wanted to buy the land back. So, and you succeeded. I don't know whether you bought all of it back or, like, was it exactly the same land that you bought back?
No. The land has actually been acquired by various friends and members of the farm community. the community support agriculture community. I never really cared that much about reclaiming the land. There's something about that kind of ownership that I think I got over. I wanted to farm. I wanted to be involved with the land, and that requires having some security with the land, some continuity. And so the land that's been acquired contiguous to the 22 acres is almost all land that's in long-term leases, and it's quite secure in terms of my knowing that I can farm it year after year.
So when you went back and started farming again, eventually you got into not only organic farming, but a community-supported agriculture group, which we'll talk about in a second. But did you try to be your father for a while first? Like when you went back to farming, did you try to do it your father's way, to do it the traditional way, or the traditional chemical way? I don't know exactly what word to use for that, to do it like your dad did.
Well, no. No, I didn't want to farm conventionally. I didn't want to farm with chemicals. I knew that. And I know that I'm like, I don't want these crops in this soil propped up with what they call now crop protectors. But back then they just called them like ag chemicals. I didn't want that. I wanted to be in this space where I was dealing with what I saw was what I was truly dealing with, not a mirage.
But for a while, you were beset with plagues of all kinds of bugs. So how did you turn that around?
Well, a lot of layers of management. Fertility practices, row covers. In organic farming, there are microbial insecticides that are permissible to use that parasitize larvae. Rotation, learning a lot, but really building the soil up more. We adopted biodynamic practices, which seems to enhance the health of the plants. So there are a lot of things that we had to put in place. It was a tremendous learning curve. I had not raised vegetables. There's all this diversity to manage. I had not farmed organically. And I also had the sense of scale that I could start off pretty big, which I was not humble enough to know that I should have started small. So tremendous learning curve, and after a few years, we started having good results.
You eventually became a CSA, a community-supported agriculture group. And this was at the suggestion of some city people who wanted to have this kind of arrangement, have this kind of relationship with your farm. For people who don't know what a CSA is, would you describe it?
Stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's a program where people sign up with the farm for a whole season, and usually it's to get vegetables from the farm, but not always, and they pay in advance to help capitalize the farm's needs for that growing season. And they enter into a relationship with the farmer and with the farm. So it's a kind of a covenant that people enter into with a piece of land. In our case, there are many people who sign up for many years in advance. We have a lot of people actually who have signed up with our farm for the next 5 years and paid for that membership.
So people pay. That helps subsidize your farm, and in return they get like a box of food every week? A box of fresh vegetables?
That's right. And they take on some risk. They agree that they'll accept what the farm provides that year. So it might be a great year, it might be a poor year. In our case, because we have enough of a land base, because our customers stepped up and bought a nice piece of land next door, we have half our land fallow every year. So we have a fantastic fertility system. So the last several years, we've just had fantastic abundance on my farm. So even though the people who sign up with our farm accept the risk, they have not encountered any shortfalls for many years.
So is the money they pay enough to keep the farm going, or is that just part of the solution to keeping it going?
Well, it's part of the solution. I mean, it does seem like it's kept some farms afloat. It's certainly brought some farms into being that otherwise never would have been there. There's, I believe, 2,000 to 3,000 CSA farms in the country now. And there are a lot of things that happen out of it. One, the source of capital does not have to go, it doesn't come from a bank. It's person to person. So it's a warm, personal source of capital. Two, it brings the customer into an understanding of the farm, because the weather that starts happening on that farm starts to be the shareholders' weather, and the crops are the shareholders' crops, or the customer's crop. So a lot of things happen that build this relationship between the farmer and the consumer that can empower farms in a lot of different ways. So often the shareholders will figure out how to help capitalize the farm in other ways.
Farmer John Peterson speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Father John, which is being released theatrically.
There was a period after you returned to farming when some of your neighbors were pretty hostile because you, again, had friends working and living on the farm and because it wasn't a traditional family kind of farm. You were accused of housing devil worshippers and people thought it was a cult group. What does it do to you when some of your neighbors in this kind of rural setting think that you're crazy and evil and demonic?
Well, actually, that hysteria started before I started up the farm again. So there were about 7 years that passed between when the farm went down and then when I started it up again as an organic farm. And a lot of other farms went down during that period. And there was quite a, I guess I'll call it a collective shadow that formed out of all that loss. And there was a lot of grief and there was a lot of confusion. And I think what happened was, rather than people take responsibility or just accept what was happening, they needed a place to project that shadow. And my farm was the right candidate. And so this dominated my life when I was on that farm for several years. And I just saw how a community can really go down and become deranged. You know, I actually became a bit deranged myself out of what was happening. But just to create a picture of it, on a nightly basis, there were kids driving in to my farm, sometimes several times a night, screaming out their window, the devil, Satan, throwing firecrackers, shooting rockets at the buildings. People were actually walking around on my farm, digging holes in the fields, looking for bones. There were a lot of
bones of
the
dead
deputies.
People you allegedly killed and buried. Is that it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And this just escalated. And I thought, well, how could this be escalating? I'm not interested in devil worship. I'm not a drug runner. I'm just someone who lost a farm.
How'd you turn that around?
Well, we had a fire on the farm, this beautiful cabin, which was a very sacred place that I had built in the woods about 12 years earlier, burned. And it was a cathartic fire, a cathartic event for me. This happened when a lot of other things were sort of crystallizing or actually reaching such an extreme hysterical point that I felt like I was losing my mind. This is my community. And then this beautiful, beautiful home burned. My friend lost all of her paintings from her whole life, all of her journals. And something snapped. And I realized in just an instant, I realized that I had to stop these visits to the farm. So the visits were coming from two sources, the kids and the deputies. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to the sheriff and I'm going to confront him and I'm going to seek his help. And I went down to the sheriff and I just stormed into his office and I confronted him. And here was this, you know, person that in right in front of him, person to person, who I think had really been kind of an enemy and definitely a suspect in his world because the whole community had all this suspicion about me. And there I was saying there was a fire, and I said, you can come to my farm and you can open every drawer and look into every closet and you can explore it all you want. And then you're going to figure out that I'm not involved in any of these things the community says I'm involved in. And then I want you to get on my side. And he was, you know, this is the great thing about humanity. It's a very human moment. He just, you know, after I said my piece, and I was quite aggressive or assertive, he said, I'll do it. I'll arrest people who are bothering you. I'll take care of you. I'll look out for you. And that's where it turned around the community, because he just started arresting people. And then the word got out that if you went to the Peterson farm to bite the heads off of squirrels or to throw firecrackers at the buildings, you're going to get arrested. And it died down pretty quickly. I mean, it took a long time to die down completely, but at least made it so that it was, you know, settled enough so I could start farming there.
Just describe for us what the land around your land is like now. Is it still family farms, corporate farms? Is it condos? What is it?
The land is these fairly big tracts are being bought up for people to plunk one big house down on. We don't have subdivisions nearby. There are restrictions against that in our township. But further out, like within a few miles, there are a lot of subdivisions. A lot of the farmland is being paved over. But in my community, there aren't many farms left, very few working farms. Ironically, we're one of the few. And the land still has a somewhat pastoral quality, but the barns are certainly caving in, the farmhouses are caving in, and there's a new kind of a kind of a gentrification that's going on in that area.
John Peterson, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your farm.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
John Peterson, speaking to Terry Gross last year. A documentary about him, called The Real Dirt on Farmer John, is being shown theatrically. Coming up, David Edelstein on three new summer movies. This is Fresh Air. As we enter what for many will be a longer than usual 4th of July weekend, three movies are expected to dominate the box office. Michael Moore's documentary Sicko, the animated Pixar film Ratatouille, and Bruce Willis's fourth go-round as Detective John McClane in Live Free or Die Hard. Critic David Edelstein reviews all three.
Two momentous films open nationwide on the same day. Sicko radically challenges our perspective on healthcare. Ratatouille radically challenges our perspective on rats in kitchens. Cynics will say there's a better chance of a rodent becoming a chef than universal health care for Americans. That underestimates the big fighting rat at the center of Sicko. Michael Moore can be a blowhard, but he's also an angry court jester speaking truth to power. When the counterculture imploded in the late 70s, the right appropriated its prankster spirit. Speaking truth to power became razzing feminazis and the so-called liberal media. Moore has reclaimed progressives' gonzo legacy. Sicko is his best film. It mixes outrage, hope, and stunts in perfect proportions. Iraq war partisans could stonewall in the face of Fahrenheit 9/11, but Sicko will whack everyone in the kidneys with a large stick. You could find millions of anecdotes of insurers denying payment, but Moore comes up with doozies. Some are ghoulishly amusing, like the guy with two fingers cut off who didn't have coverage to get both reattached. He had to choose between the ring finger for $12,000 and the middle finger for $60,000. Figuratively speaking, Moore gives the insurance company the middle finger. Other stories are tragic. People whose insurers deny their claims expire before the appeals process runs its course, leaving stricken spouses and children. Moore plays a clip from the 1996 congressional testimony of an industry whistleblower.
There was one person in the healthcare industry who did have a conscience. Dr. Linda Pino, a former medical reviewer at Humana.
My name is Linda Pino. I am here primarily today to make a public confession. In the spring of 1987, as a physician, I denied a man a necessary operation that would have saved his life and thus caused his death. No person and no group has held me accountable for this, because in fact, what I did was I saved a company $500,000 for this. And furthermore, this particular act secured my reputation as a good medical director, and it ensured my continued advancement in the healthcare field. I went from making a few hundred dollars a week as a medical reviewer to an escalating six-figure income as a physician executive. In all my work, I had one primary duty, and that was to use my medical expertise for the financial benefit of the organization for which I worked. And I was told repeatedly that I was not denying care, I was simply denying payment. I know how managed care maims and kills patients. So I'm here to tell you about the dirty work of managed care. And I'm haunted by the thousands of pieces of paper on which I have written that deadly word, denied. Thank you.
It's the HMO Kaiser Permanente, though, that emerges as a supervillain, if only because of an astounding 1971 tape of an Oval Office meeting between John Ehrlichman and Richard Nixon. Nixon is convinced to go along with Edgar Kaiser's scheme to create a for-profit managed care system on the grounds that hospitals would have incentives to give less care. Material this potent doesn't need angry emphasis. Instead, Moore's persona is sorrowful, sympathy for the neglected, mock incredulousness over why this has to be. The second half is a travelogue. He journeys to Canada, the UK, and France to see how people bear up under national health care. Perhaps he paints a rosy picture, and a survey of Cuban health care leaves out less savory details of life under Castro. But the differences in coverage between our system and other countries are profound. Moore argues that Americans take dead-end jobs for insurance and stay because employers have them over a barrel. He says, transform healthcare and you'll remake society. History suggests the healthcare industry will pay through the nose to ensure that the system never changes. But after Sicko, how can Americans let politicians feed them sugar pills? Brad Bird's Ratatouille is a high watermark for its director, too. Since Bird's previous features are The Iron Giant and The Incredibles, that's higher than the Eiffel Tower. Our Parisian rat hero, Remy, does not share his family's taste for garbage. He loves fresh ingredients combined in unexpected ways. It's an archetypal story, a youth who insists on going his own way in the face of a disapproving dad and a society that sees him in but one role. What makes it less sentimental is the visceral incongruity of its happiest image, a rat on a stovetop improvising over a soup pot. You think yuck and yum at the same instant. Bird charges the space the way Spielberg does. His animated characters seize the foreground, making you sit up like a rat catching a whiff of cheese. Maybe Tom de Savoie shaved lightly over truffle-scented petit pois. Can Brad Bird cook? The week's other blockbuster is the third Die Hard sequel, Live Free or Die Hard. Bruce Willis returns with his head shaved. He no longer seems like Detective John McClane. He's Bruce Willis with his all-purpose smirk. The movie combines brutal action with high-tech cyber thrills and the pacing of TV's 24. It's watchable, but the strands don't coalesce. The climax is by the numbers. The best reason to see it is the young actor Justin Long of the TV series Ed and those Apple versus PC commercials. He plays an ace hacker, and the tension between his shambling gait and his lightning way with a keyboard and with geek banter leaves Bruce eating his dust. Willis does get entertainingly bashed up, though. Let's hope the NYPD has a decent insurance plan.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. From The Dial Press, publisher of The Manny, a novel about life on the wealthiest acre of Manhattan's Upper East Side, by Holly Peterson. And from Debbie and Norris Bishton, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, school integration, executions, and bong hits for Jesus. We talk about recent issues facing the Supreme Court with Linda Greenhouse, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. Join us for the next Fresh Air.